Let's change the world together. Welcome to the Snapcast, the podcast for all nonprofit professionals, bringing you interviews and amazing ideas for nonprofit leaders.
Hello, this is Mickey Desai. I'm your host for this episode of the Nonprofit Snapcast. I am very lucky to have Lisa Ruppel on the line with me today. Lisa, how are you?
Doing great. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. I have your little intro in front of me. I wanted to read it for our audience. You've worked in nonprofits, government, philanthropy for over 15 years. You started your career in the Civil War battlefield preservation field, working for the National Park Service. And I see this note you've made. You've assessed over 1 million acres of battlefield land in the U.S., and you have the deer tick stories to show for it. What on earth? 1 million acres?
So small disclaimer, I did not hike 1 million acres, but I did spend a lot of time in the car, and I did do a lot of aerial photography research. So any current aerial images I could use to get to areas that I couldn't physically get to or physically see with my eyes. And I did almost 60 battlefield sites. Some were over 20,000 acres. So you can't quite possibly get to all of that on foot, but I did the best I could. It was fascinating work. I loved every minute of it, even the ticks in the middle of the thick woods, looking for old fortifications and having sometimes with partners and sometimes just solo. I almost fell into the Potomac River once. It was great. So, yeah.
Oh, my gosh. That's just amazing. I mean, you know, I love getting out as much as any other red-blooded guy, but ticks freak me right the heck out. It's just...
Yes. As they freak me out as well. Deer ticks and wood ticks. I have experience with two kinds. It's great. Do the best you can and take the precautions you can, but you don't want to let it keep you from doing what you want to do, right?
So how did you get into that? I mean, I know we're completely off topic now, but how did you, Civil War battlefield preservation? And when you're assessing a battlefield, what does that mean you're doing to it?
Yeah, great. So I got into it actually straight out of my graduate program. So I went to a graduate program for historic preservation in Eastern Michigan University, and I was getting ready to graduate. I've always had an interest in military history. It was my undergrad degree had a focus on that, and discovered that the National Park Service had a program that solely focused on battlefield preservation of any war, Civil War, Revolutionary War, War of 1812, Indian Wars, things like that. They had an internship, and I reached out to the program to say, to apply. And I got a phone call from the chief of the program saying, "Hey, would you like a job?" I said, "Absolutely, I would like a job." So, within a 2-week time span, we were uprooting and moving to Washington, D.C. and helping update this congressional study. So that there had been an original study in the 90s to figure out how many battlefields were there that were of a certain level that merited preservation, so they could put money behind, protecting battlefield land and preserving that history. And then it was in 2003, they decided we better update because we don't know how much land is left. We know that there's a lot that didn't get preserved. And there was a lot of Walmarts and a lot of housing developments that had, happened since that time. So they were hiring folks to do that work. And so they have an entire methodology for how you go about assessing a battlefield. And you use primary research, you're using after action reports, which are written after the battle is over. Officers are writing, here's what happened, and they will use landmarks that they saw to help describe 200 yards from where the church was, or a certain intersection, or a river, or a geologic feature. And those are the things I would comb through the records and just pull out those little pieces. So I could map and what we call ground truth. You go out and you look at what's there today. Oh, there's still a church, at that spot, or the road network hasn't changed all that much. So it really follows the historic maps, because I would use historic maps as well and overlap them with modern maps to help orient me where I was. So it was really just fascinating stuff. And you just get this real deep immersion into the battle and the people who were involved and how, landscape really shaped how a battle played out. And it's a moment in time. So it's really may happen for a couple of days, or if it's a siege, maybe a couple of weeks, but that's it, and then the farmers go back and take their land back and start tilling the fields, and or cities grow and things get demolished. And so my job was to just pick out what's left.
That's amazing.
And then we would, so yeah, so it was really fascinating work that I got to do. I was very lucky to be able to do that.
So I have to ask, I mean, it sounds like it brushes up against archaeology in a major way.
Mm-hmm. For sure.
What's the most interesting thing you've discovered? And then we'll jump into our topics, the original purpose for us getting together here.
Yes, right. Yeah. I could talk battlefields, battlefield preservation all day long. So,
yeah.
But I have to say, archaeology wise, we didn't do that much in-depth, any kind of archaeological studies, because that takes months and months and lots of research and things like that. But, I met a lot of interesting folks who were very passionate about, preserving the battlefield. I met one fellow who, has an archaeological twist to it. One fellow who, generations of families had lived on his land, which was within the battlefield, and it was their hobby to go down by the creek and just pick up spent mini bullets and anything else metal they could find, buckles and buttons and anything mm-hmm. that got dropped, So an entire lifetime's worth of collection of artifacts from this battlefield were in his garage in mason jars.
Oh my gosh. Which,
cool for the family, but the second you pull that out of the ground, we lose that as a record. Yeah. Right. The only way we might be able to know where the Union line was along a certain ridge would be from what was dropped, So the second they collect that, it's like that record is completely gone. So right. Yeah. So he was so proud to tell me about his garage full of mason jars, and I did the best I could. Like, that's really interesting, that you get. Yeah, I don't want to be mean or be judgmental, but at the same time, it's like, well, this is not helping my work right now. But I think it's cool that you're excited about it. He was very, very passionate about protecting the battlefield, so it's a give and take. So that's my one of my more favorite archaeology encounters, I guess you could say.
That is really, really interesting. So I have to ask the next question: how do you go mm-hmm. from battlefield preservation to crisis communications?
Yeah. So, just a bit of a journey there. The work we were doing was time sensitive once the study was up. Essentially I was worried about being able to continue on. I had other opportunities to come, back to my home state of Ohio and work for the state, doing a statewide history program. And really there you're the face of, a public face of the program. So that really got me, oriented to how you're talking to the public, what's important for them to know. It's public history, so it's their information. It's all, it's taxpayer supported, and we want to make sure that they have the best information possible. And from there, I built that on that into communications work for nonprofits. I managed communications department for a community foundation here in Ohio, and I did that for probably a good 5 years, and took that was, a very minimal communications work that they were doing, and kind of turned it into a much more thoughtful and strategized department. And part of that work was, we need to have a plan for if things happen. We had a lot going on in the community at the time that we needed to be responsive to, as far as, there's a big opioid problem. While I was there, we were figuring out how to address that. There were other controversies happening with, it was like a county focused community foundation. So wherever it hit up against our mission, which we had a lot of different nonprofits we would support, we needed to be ready to know what we needed to say and have a team in place so that we had a spokesman identified, we had talking points ready to go. If we got calls from the press, who was fielding those? Didn't always make sense for it to be me, because I may not be the subject matter expert, but I definitely can coach that person if mm-hmm. It felt like we needed to take it to that next level. Fortunately or not, we didn't have anything on the level of what we're dealing with now, but I think the fundamentals that you put into place serve you a heck of a lot better than trying to like build the airplane while you're flying it, right? Mm-hmm. Trying to put a communications plan in place in the middle of what we're going through right now. It's a lot to ask. Folks are doing it. I'm seeing some really amazingly creative things that are happening and just sort of out of necessity. But I think the groundwork people are building right now can serve them, as they move forward. Hopefully as we come out of this and life assumes it's new normal, that they'll be that much stronger for it, and have that much closer connection with their donors, their constituents, you know, anyone that they serve, and maybe even beyond. So, so that was sort of, you know, my fundamental beginnings there. And then, now I do, freelance work doing content strategy and content writing for nonprofits and foundations and, even some business. So it's fundamentally all the same for me. I come at it from an audience, start first with who you're talking to, understand what their experience is and where you intersect with that experience, and then understand what do they need to know, how much do they need to know, and then what is it that's specific to you that you're helping them, right, solve their problem. Go ahead.
No, I was going to say, I think that's a very important piece that I don't want to gloss over. You have to start with the audience experience. You have to meet them. You have to meet them on the ground that they currently think is stable. Right.
Right. Right. And for a lot of us, I mean, myself included, you know, this is different than what we think of traditionally as crisis management. Usually it's a crisis from within that you're trying to manage, right? It's an internal, something's happened in the organization and you have to manage the information that's coming out. And ideally you're being as upfront and transparent as possible. You're telling all of it, you know, you want to make sure you get all of it out there, so that there's no surprises that drip later on. And then also talk about what you're doing to mitigate it. This is what we're doing about it. We're studying this, or this person's been, there's been, action that's been taken, if it's around an employee or a board member or whatnot. But, so you kind of get ahead of the story a bit, right? Or try to manage how the story flows as best you can. This is all external. I mean, this is, and everyone is having a shared experience right now, which is just, something that's really unique and different than what we've had to traditionally deal with crisis communication. So I think that's really critical when it comes down to, we don't have control over the virus, right, or its effects, but we can control our role as a nonprofit and the value that we always provide with the mission. Mm-hmm. So that's something to think about. It's just sort of place yourself in context of how you intersect with the, you know, so say you're a food bank. And you're having a direct essential role in feeding families right now. And for many, they may have never visited a food distribution center before, and have to take advantage of it now. So think about that. Like, for that's your specific audience person. Like, where do they need to go? Is there a certain driveway they need to come into? Versus, you know, you're doing a one-way route. You're dealing with crowd control. They're dealing with, I don't even understand how this process works. You know, what paperwork do I need to fill out? Can I do that ahead of time? You know, wearing masks, essentially, like, what are you doing to keep me safe as your customer, your client, your donor or participant? What are you doing to keep your people safe, right? Your staff and your volunteers. And then, to me, it's all interrelated. So I want that communicated to me, make it as easy to understand, as easy to find as possible. Help me navigate. I need to use your service, but help me understand.
Right.
How am I going to do that safely?
So let's back up for a second and let me ask a potentially stupid question, which is there is a difference between emergency communications and crisis communications, or is that not accurate?
I think emergency communications, I mean, to me would be if the person is experiencing an emergency and what do they need to do? It's a crisis hotline for mental health,
right?
So that's something that's very specific to them. Go ahead.
I was just wondering, is there a difference between needing to say, hey, the building's on fire versus, okay, this is what's happened. This is what you need to do now that the building is no longer on fire. Is that a valid distinction and is it, or even a worthy one?
I think it's important to be flexible too, right? If the building's on fire, that's an emergency everybody's going to need to know about.
Yeah.
And then once that's resolved, have a plan for how you're communicating. These are how our services have changed, as a result of the fire. So being able to respond in the moment and then having, thought through how are we changing our services around this emergency that's just happened.
Mm-hmm.
Does that help?
Okay. Absolutely. And so what you would recommend a nonprofit do is actually keep the pieces to those individual types of communications in their pocket, as you know, keep the plan ready to go for any of those contingencies, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, I think I definitely think right now everything's on fire, right? Yeah. You know, like everything, we're shut down. People are we have stay at home orders. You know, our local library has just furloughed most of its staff, right? Mm-hmm. So that's an emergency communication that they're sending out. We are furloughed. There's not a whole lot that they're going to be able to do once the furlough ends. There's a whole communications plan that needs to be around that to help patrons understand, how am I going to be able to use my library again, right? And also in an emergency saying, you can still access all of our digital resources. You know, there's key staff we're keeping. Again, that's that transparency. Like, this is how we made the decision to who we're furloughing and, you know, maybe for how long. And then also, again, how it affects you, the patron. That's where your communication strategy comes in, to say, look, you can still access digital communications. You can still contact us if you need help or questions or have issues. And it's just a little bit more thoughtful. Like, they can't just call their branch. They have to call a specific number, or they have to email a certain specific email address, and maybe that's something you've set up because of the furlough. So it's definitely just kind of trying to look at, again, what are all the moving parts, and understanding, like, what do our patrons need to know? And how often does it make sense for us to be communicating these things?
Right. So let's pretend for a minute that I'm a nonprofit that's just starting to think about formalizing a crisis communications plan. What are some of the things that I need to do to make that as effective as it can be?
Yeah, I think importantly, it's to think about having a team. And that can be essentially folks to help from the top down and bottom up, help make some of those decisions. Like, who are we talking to, and what's important for them to know? So if you have, you know, certainly at minimum your executive director, it's important to have your board chair involved. If you have a staff person who's handling your HR, most nonprofits, I don't think, have a specific HR person, at least not the ones that I've, you know, been dealt with. But if you have legal counsel, that's a good idea. Maybe there's a board member who, you know, can provide some legal counsel. And then obviously your communications person, or the person who handles communications, if you don't have a dedicated person. Mm-hmm. So that's really important. And understand, you know, choose, like, who's going to be your spokesperson. And then maybe a few backup people. Because right now, with this the situation as it is, folks can fall ill, unfortunately, you know, and so your primary spokesperson might be not available for 2 weeks or 10 days or what have you. So it's important to say, well, first we'll go to the executive director. If they are the typical face of the organization, or the communications person, would make sense. And then think of, who can we, you know, is there a program person who's been with the organization for a long time and is comfortable being able to talk to the public or the media or whatnot. So it's just be thoughtful about who do you have on your team, and get them together. And then think about how you're going to send out updates. Is it email? Is it letter? Does it need to be a blend, social media? So just be thoughtful about it. And again, it comes back to audience. How are they receiving messages? And if you've got some that are mostly on Facebook, then that might be one way to do it. I always advocate, make sure you have a dedicated space on your website. If it's a news update page, if it's a place you put your press releases, some place that you're sending people back to, no matter if you're sending out an email or it's going out on social media, always send them back to your website. That's just a good communications practice. And, you know, determine that high level critical information you need to share. And again, I mentioned before about transparency and what actions you're taking and why, you know, so some of the messaging we talked about earlier. So once the team kind of agrees on all of those things, then you can come up with, sort of implement that plan and think about your messaging around the specific things you need to be communicating to them about. And this can all be done remotely. I mean, we have most people are now using a lot of the remote connection software, right? So, meet, and it doesn't have to take forever, but meet and just kind of think through, these are the top level things we need to make decisions on right now. And then you have a little bit of a plan of action to get things going. Mm-hmm.
I'm sitting here nodding quite a bit. No one can see it, but yeah.
So assemble the team, your team of Avengers, I like to think of it. And then, you know, when it comes to, I'm a big proponent of having a kit, a universal one location communications kit. And this gets into the sustainability part. So, creating a communications kit that, your team can access from anywhere they are 24/7. You can update it in real time. So as messaging changes, you know, for instance, with the food bank, you have to change locations because you can't handle that volume of people at one location. So you're going to an alternate site. You can go into your communications kit and update all the talking points and update. And I'll talk about, you know, what's good to have in the kit. But then that way, everybody's going there. You're not emailing a PDF. You're not emailing a Word doc with talking points in it that's 2 days old. And maybe someone forgets and they go back to their email rather than getting the newest talking points. So in essence, it's keeping consistent information across the board, with your entire organization. This is not just your crisis team that would access this. This is everybody who, you know, is interacting with the public or your donors or whatever the audience is, you know, whoever they need to be talking to.
So just to make sure I'm clear on this, you're talking about a kit as a resource for all your internal stakeholders. And, and so would that be a series of Google documents? Would that be, what would that look like exactly?
I mean, it could be, whatever kind of a cloud system, you know, that the nonprofit is used to using. If they're on Microsoft 365, it might be a SharePoint or a OneDrive type of thing, or Google Docs are great. Most folks can access those pretty easily with a shared link. So it could be just as simple as here's one document that's got all of our talking points in it. So and by audience member. So if you're talking to library patrons, right, about the fact that how to navigate the online digital resources. So there's some talking points for folks, because there may be folks who are now answering questions that haven't done it before, because we're all restructuring and reorganizing, being flexible and pivoting and all this stuff. So they may not know the very deep levels of tech support, but you can give them the basic information to at least help with the most frequently asked questions, which is another piece that is important to include, is that audience feedback. So if you're constantly fielding phone calls, getting questions from the website or on social media asking, hey, you know, I don't know where to go for XYZ, then you can make that top level, you know, either on the website or within the talking points to make it easy for people to get the information that they're asking about. Really, it's, you know, clearly labeled by audience. There can be another document with social media. So you've got social media messaging where you can have copy paste, you know, information so folks can share on their own networks of your internal staff. Because I'm a big fan of not just having the organization social media talking about it, but having your brand ambassadors, your larger social media network, help you share and broadcast that message. So, it can just be a series of links to the posts you've already posted from the organization's account. And then they can go in there and share those posts, you know, so they don't have to write anything other than here's the latest update.
Right.
So just making it easy as possible for them to access the information. It could be call scripts if they're answering the phones or answering via email. So you want everyone to say the same thing across the board and there's no mixed information. You're sending them to the right place on the website for resources or sign up forms or things like that. So it's thinking through, you know, what are all, again, back to your crisis team, what do they need to know? How much do they need to know and how are we going to get it to them? Mm-hmm. And then I also recommend if there's a need to point people to resources outside of your organization, you know, think through what are some trusted accounts that you know are going to give good real-time updates that it's not websites you're not familiar with or organizations you're not familiar with. So if you've got some that your state's health department, for instance, is a good place to point them if it's more COVID related and less your mission related and they want to know what are my symptoms. That's not something that necessarily, unless you are, you know, a health organization, that you may be wanting to field. So
right,
if you're an animal shelter, okay, check out the state's health department. You know, that's a great great resource for you. You know, and there's some really good resources out there right now on communications kits. The Communications Network has a triage kit, and it's live updated. I believe it's a Google Doc. So I highly recommend folks can check that out. They put that out within days of this evolving, and they continue to evolve it. So it's you know, communications professionals across the U.S. just providing their insight, and it's a lot of copy paste messaging. Yep. It's a lot of things they can use.
So I'm going to try to summarize here. Please correct me where I'm wrong, mm-hmm. or completely, you know, tell me what I'm forgetting. And then I'm wondering if you could provide an example, mm-hmm. an example of these practices in place. So meet your audience where they live, meet them on their mm-hmm. emotional turf, and put the message to them in calm, meaningful ways. And then mm-hmm. make the message itself is simple. Give it to them in a very transparent way, give the message in a very transparent way, and behind the scenes for your staff, get your kit together. That would be the living document you're talking about. Mm-hmm. Get all the materials as they evolve to be consumed in one place by your internal staff, and make sure that they know how to deliver the message if one person, the spokesperson, is not solely responsible for doing it. Mm-hmm. What did I miss?
I think you've got
I mean,
that's the gist, right? Yeah.
Yeah. That's the 5-mile view, I think.
right. Yeah. Yes.
And I'm sure I could get way more granular, but for the purposes of this podcast, right. Can you provide a quick example of what an organization has done in this regard?
So, to use a local example, I'm in Northeast Ohio. I'm in the Cleveland metropolitan area. And there is a park system, the Cleveland Metro Parks. I think they did a really nice job with getting information out there quickly. One of the few things that did not close in Ohio when we had the stay-at-home order first enacted here were parks. You could still go to your county parks or state parks, stayed open, and our Cleveland Metro Park system did a great job. They put up, you know, an entire page on their website. They made it easy to find from the homepage. So it's right at the top in red. You know, here's the latest for updated closures, for any programs we've canceled. You can click here, and then it's an entire landing page of all this information. Here's all the parks. They put out, again, specific to their expertise. So here's safe practices when you're outside. Here's visually what this looks like for social distancing, you know, because initially we were all struggling with what does social distancing mean? It's a new word to all of us, right? And we learned a lot of you know, terms that were unfamiliar to us, PPE and things like that. So they took it in context of their mission and made it hopefully make sense for their constituents. So, you know, they have, best practices for when you're on the trail, and it's great because they put together these images that are still true to their mission, but also a little bit lighthearted, right? So they talk mm-hmm. about, you know, help us keep our parks open and stay 6 feet apart. And they have an image of a turkey vulture, which has a 6-foot wingspan in between two people hiking, right? So that's right. An image that they put on their website, and then they shared it on social media. They have a couple of different versions, but it's just kind of a fun visual image to help people remember this is what 6 feet looks like, but it's 6 feet within our context, you know. And I've seen other park districts do similar things with, you know, you name it. The National Park Service has done some really fun things too. They have a whole Sasquatch themed, you know, what you need to know about hiking in our parks and staying safe and right. Staying apart. So they, and then they have safety videos. So here's how, I mean, again, they have a much larger probably communications team than most nonprofits do. So you may not be able to do, yeah. you know, high-end produced videos, but you can do cell phone videos. You know, those are fairly easy to do with your executive director talking, and that's so shareable and very easy to, for folks to, you know, a lot of people, Vodeo is still very popular and does really well, but talking about, you know, stay off the playgrounds and don't leave yeah. trash behind. Don't drop your, you know, plaster, your latex gloves on the ground and things like that. So, so it's very good it's a very good example. So if folks want to have that as an example, clevelandmetroparks.com is the website, and they can go. And then it also has up to the minute, you know, alerts and closures. They're going to start opening more things up here soon in Ohio. So again, that talks about once the fire's over, you know, then moving into the next phase. So I'm going to be watching their website to kind of see how they're transitioning their communications into things are starting to open, but they're not like back to what it was before.
Right.
It's still going to be different. You still have to mitigate. You still have to manage. The other thing that the Metro Parks has done is they took all their, you know, programs and turned them into virtual programs. So they did a ton of virtual classrooms and communicate, you know, instructions and things like that. So they really tried to keep their folks engaged that way, instead of just kind of disappearing. Right.
Well, and I think that to speak to your original point, it's if it's crisis communications, there's nothing that says your organization can't keep its spirit during those crisis communications, right? I mean, you're still allowed to deliver. I mean, sure, it's a serious moment, it's a serious set of circumstances, but you can. There's still a place to inject the lighthearted feel that we all, you know, carry our normal business with. But
yeah, and we need it now, right? You know, like. It's important to stay authentic and stay true to the values and the mission that your organization has. You know, you have a relationship with your audience, so your donors and your clients and all of that. They already know you, and so it's just continuing that on. But it also builds hopefully a level of trust. You know, you're building this relationship with them by saying we're keeping you informed. We want you to know we're figuring this out too. It's a work in progress. We're trying to be as flexible as we can. And here's what we have so far. You know, we will update you as needed, you know, as things change, and wanting to keep you safe and keep us safe. And but again, yeah, putting it in terms of the context specific to your mission, I think that's really where the value is for nonprofits and talking to their constituents, because to go back to the food bank example, you know, it's important for, you know, a lot of the folks that may not be as familiar with food insecurity, you know, it's a good time to be able to say, you know, it's important to understand there are certain times of the month that, you know, SNAP recipients are receiving their benefits, and maybe you can shop accordingly if there are, you know, look, these are what labels to look for in the grocery store. So maybe you can choose alternate items and leave those other items for families in need. You know, because they can only purchase so many items, specific items with the benefits. So, so it's thinking about what's our unique value that we provide. Our animal shelter, right, in the neighboring county where I adopted my cat from, they decided to do puppy and kitten delivery. You know, so if you wanted to adopt, you could still adopt. And that was part of their communications, like, hey, oh, yes, we're shut down. You cannot come in and visit. You know, the animals, but we'll bring them to you, you know, and they really would. They would drive over and meet you someplace and figure out a way to do, as minimal contact as possible.
Right.
If you wanted to foster or adopt, it was brilliant.
So there's always a way to do it.
Always a way. Yeah. I mean, if more creative, and we've all had to be kind of nimble and flexible. And I think, being able to communicate that is appreciated, you know, like, it's going to make me less likely to interact with a store, or if I have to go someplace, if I don't understand, you know, how are you managing this? If you're just trying to, if you haven't changed your website at all, that to me says, you know, I'm not really sure how you're responding to this current situation, and I really want to know, you know, what are you doing?
Lisa, this is fascinating. I realize we're very close to being out of time. I hope we can revisit at some point in the future and have more of these conversations on this kind of thing in the future.
Yeah, absolutely. That would be, I would love to chat further. And if you ever decide to do a battlefield preservation podcast, please let me know.
You know, I find this stuff just endlessly fascinating. We might have to have that conversation. If a listener wanted to be in touch with you, would it be appropriate, and how would they get in touch with you?
Yeah, I think probably the best way is they're welcome to reach out to me on LinkedIn and connect, or even via my email. Which is basically my first initial last name at gmail.com. So it's LRU2PSAS@gmail.com. And they're welcome to reach out. I'm happy to answer any questions that they may have. If they want, you know, more resources or examples, you know, I'm also happy to share that as well.
You're awesome. Thank you, Lisa. Thank you for joining me for this episode of the Nonprofit Snapcast.
Great. Thank you so much. It was a real pleasure to chat with you.
And to our listeners, thank you as always for joining us. We hope you find these conversations useful. If you don't mind, please leave us some feedback on the Apple Podcast portal or Spotify or wherever you find the Nonprofit Snapcast. Your ratings make us more searchable to other people. And in the meantime, we'll have another episode for you in about a week.
This has been the Snapcast. Thank you for joining us.